Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Okay. Hi. How you doing?
You actually going to have your level up so people can hear you this time?
Eventually, yes, I will. I will.
All right. We are tackling 1990s, part two, because, like I said last week, I really thought we'd be able to do that all in 55 minutes. We just start arguing.
No, we've discovered some amazing things about your psyche, Josh, I think, last week. That
because the 90s was a dark void of uncreativity, and
in your brain,
it deserves to cease existing even in people's memories.
Yes. In your brain, yes. Many of us have great and wonderful memories from the 90s, and
many of you are insane.
Judging by the reaction from people, we touched a nerve with this one.
Yeah, so?
Yeah. Anyway, so, first off, let's say we want to relive some of the good parts of the 90s, like Animaniacs and stuff like that, buy them on DVD. Where's a good place to go?
The internet?
Amazon.com specifically.
Amazon?
Amazon.com.
That's not what you said. You said Amazon.
Shut up. I'm trying to do the promo here. We're not even into the topic and you're already arguing with me. This is going to be a good show.
I thought that's what our dynamic was.
No, it wasn't. It's never been that. It's just, yeah, okay, yes. Anyway, go to 1201beyond.com. Shut off the ad blocker. Clear your cookies. Follow our little link of suggestions of things that you should get and watch and read and et cetera, et cetera. Dr. Pepper good?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Dr. Pepper was good.
follow our suggestions, one of which we could add would be Animaniacs on DVD. Go to Amazon. Doesn't cost you a penny more. Excuse me. Doesn't cost you a penny more. We're not quite to the point to where we can give you a break yet, but we're working on that. But you help us out, you get a nice warm feeling, and you get the DVD or whatever the hell you wanted ordered anyway.
All right. So where'd we leave off with 1990s?
We left off with you. We discussed CGI into the ground, and we found out that...
Well, okay.
We found out a lot of stuff.
Actually, as I was thinking about it through the week, there's something more I wanted to add about the CGI of the
90s. What's that?
I didn't mind certain CGI elements of the 90s when the item was supposed to look like CGI or something out of a dream or whatnot. Then the bad CGI actually added to a dreamlike quality. For instance, in like Clive Barker's Lord of Illusions, you don't know she's in a dream at first until these horrible CG creatures start attacking her. Then when she touches one, it disintegrates into like horrible green screen. And according to Clive on the commentary, that was intentional. That they said they made those creatures look much more realistic. And he said, no, but I want this to immediately be identifiable as not reality. So I'm okay with bad CGI when it's supposed to add to an ethereal sort of quality. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I wanted to add that, you know, bad CGI, or even like, you know, even though this is 89, like The Abyss, the CGI water tentacle.
Yes.
It was supposed to be something totally alien. So having it not look totally realistic actually kind of helps with what they were going for.
Then what about the baddies in, like, Captain Power?
No, those just looked bad.
Yeah, I'll give you that. They did.
Those were just the technology could not do what they wanted them to do.
Agreed, but.
Just, you know, throughout the week as I was thinking about that, I just wanted to add that bad CGI of the 90s can work if it was supposed to be like in a dream or even that virtual reality shit like Lawnmower Man. That wasn't supposed to look real.
Right.
And so the bad CG there did kind of add to that.
Okay.
All right, so where are we going next?
I'm going to let that one lay. But so what was your uniform in the 90s?
Uniform?
Well, by uniform was, you know, we all kind of, you got up, you put on clothes. Let me
guess. You're going to make fun of me, but it's pretty much the way I dress today. I usually have ripped jeans, an old t-shirt with holes in it, a trench coat, and a backwards hat. Yes, for those out there who've seen photos of me in high school, without the beard and the gut yet, I looked like Silent Bob before Silent Bob. Because I was looking like that in 91. Silent Bob didn't exist till 94.
True. And so you pretty much, and I'm guessing you had a similar uniform in the 80s, right?
Yeah, you know me. I'm not really one for change. You know, I've got a look I like. Ripped jeans, an old ripped t-shirt, trench coat. That's the style I go for.
Okay.
I find something I like, I stick with it. What's your fucking problem?
Nothing. Nothing. Nothing at all. You two business professionals can hire this man. Anyway.
And why are we jumping to fashion? Wasn't TV next on the list?
I don't want to grow up. No, we talked about TV. We talked about animation. We talked about it.
All right, fine.
We're there.
All right. Continue on with your fashion rant.
So in the 90s, I
think fashion was actually worse in the 90s than in the 70s.
I
think bell bottoms, which ironically enough still came back in the late 90s
in
too.
In the 2000s,
but,
yeah.
Well, no, the late 90s, people were still wearing bell bottoms.
Okay, all right. The way I looked in the 90s isn't that much different than today. Basically, it's what
hair.
Well, yeah, of course. And actually, in the 90s, no, I really didn't.
The early 90s.
Well, even in the, well, yeah, I started losing my hair about 1991.
Still in high school.
Yeah, I know. But nonetheless, it was jeans, t-shirt with something, I don't know, kind of goofy on it, like mine that just says geek right now. Flannel shirt, sometimes a leather jacket.
You went with the flannel grunge look.
Did you
really went grunge?
I was a slacker.
Oh.
And I don't know if it was really going grunge, because you... It was in the 90s that I was hanging out with all my IT buddies. And I hate to say it, but you can pick out an IT department out of a crowd. Because they're the ones that are like, I'm going to wake up and, oh, this is near the bed. We'll put this on.
See, I used to do the whole, you got to remember, I'm still, you know, living with my mom at this point and whatnot. You know, I'm still in high school. I used to wake up and do the whole, you pick up a t-shirt, go to, hey, Ma, does this smell too bad to wear one more time?
I never even asked my mother. I was out.
So, yeah,
and in the 90s, they've invented Febreze.
I know, but my thing always was, does this smell too bad to wear one more day before I actually have to wash it?
And even if it did, you just hang it out your dorm window for a day, and it picks up the fresh air. Anyway.
In like 91, I'm in high school. What dorm?
Oh, yeah. You went to normal high school.
Yeah, I'm living with my mom because I'm a fucking sophomore in high school.
I got to remember that.
So it's like, it's not that weird for me to still be living with my mom in 91.
I got to remember that I went to a weird high school. Anyway, it was throughout the 90s, and I'm also thinking college 90s. Yeah, I didn't quite go grunge because you had the slackers like me. It was, you know, t-shirt, flannel, depending on the season, jacket, hat, and coffee. And then you had, it was goths before they were goths.
Yeah, we had goth yeah, guys,
you know,
and chicks
guys,
in my
guys
high
and
school
chicks that they maybe they wear the nail polish, maybe they put a little mascara on, but they weren't goths back then, and they weren't shitting bats at that point. They were just slackers with fashion sense.
No, I think that was more of the early death metal guys.
Yeah.
You know, the death metal crowd before death metal became, oh God, I can't believe I'm about to use this term, socially acceptable.
See, the death metal crowd where I was, they always had the inverted pentacles and the bats and
the ones I had looked like younger versions of Death Clock.
Yeah,
that was my high school.
Yeah,
kind
of that way.
The death metal guys.
I mean, fashion in the 90s was comfortable. You had a major switchover, and this actually started in the late 80s or so. But if you look back to, let's say, retail, And you look back to even a great British comedy that was filmed in the 60s and 70s, Are You Being Served? Are you familiar with it?
Familiar with it, but I don't think I've ever actually seen one.
But if you pay attention to that show, for instance, if we're working at the same store, and I've got a young lady who comes up and says, I'm looking for blah, do you have blah, and you're in charge of the department that sells blah, I would take the young lady over and I would say, Mr. Hadley, are you free? And you would respond with something like, yes, Mr. Murray, I am. Or, no, Mr. Murray, I'm busy at the moment, could you hold on? And you got to remember that through the 70s and the early, well, even depending on the business, as far as the late 80s, business was a very formal thing. You put on your suit, you went to work. You didn't work for Chuck or Steve or Tom. You worked for Mr. Smith, or you worked, you know, even. That's one thing that set a lot of people apart, and you knew that you had made it, was if you had a secretary that you could call her by her first name. You know, the ones up in charge could call you Josh and me Scott, but we would have to refer to them as Mr. or Miss blah blah blah.
What does this have to do with fashion?
This has to do with fashion, because in the 90s, that attitude changed. In the late 80s, early 90s, that formality of business fell away and fashion followed, and we got this thing called business casual. And it's why today, instead of having to wear a suit, unless you're a lawyer or something,
we already
like
talked
that,
about that in one of the short tates,
yeah,
episodes.
Instead of having to wear a suit, you can go to work in a pair of khakis and a polo shirt.
Now, when was the shoulder pads thing for chicks? Was that 80s?
That was 80s.
Okay.
That was 80s.
Because I remember that. I think that still bled into the 90s. Because I remember some of my teachers in high school were still them big shoulder paddy things.
That's just because sometimes people take a while to catch up to things. But the shoulder pads had pretty much died by 1990.
Okay.
Thank
you. I couldn't remember exactly when the shoulder pad craze was.
Believe it or part of the reason that the shoulder pad craze died,
they look, because you started to look like something out of the Road Warrior?
Well, yeah, I mean, other than looking like you had a 2x4 plastered to your shoulders, it also, Star Trek The Next Generation.
Men in skirts?
What?
In the pilot episode of TNG, the guys wore skirts, red shirts and
that's
stuff.
Right. No. Yes, they had a lot of costumes that had huge shoulder pads to them, but they were usually aliens, and people started looking at them and going, that looks ridiculous. And then
always looked ridiculous.
If you look at the actual crew members, their uniforms, and even in the early ones, the ladies didn't have the shoulder pads. That was part of the, seriously, that was where the genesis of ladies losing the gigantic shoulder pads.
But that was 87, so.
That was 87, but it took a while to bleed in. Anyway, fashion in the 90s was comfortable. Even, like I said, even in a business thing, you had business casual pop up, and thanks again to the technology sector and the big internet boom of
well,
the
90s.
We'll get there, but thanks to the tech sector and the internet boom in the 90s, people started looking at, for instance, IT professionals and going, wow, you have good results. You have created a business and you're not in a suit.
I in the 2000s, back when you and I worked at, well, no, this is before we knew each other. This is back when I worked at Channel 2. I went into a pizza place regularly on my lunch, dressed like pretty much like I am now.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy asked where I worked. And when I told him I worked at the TV station as a cameraman, he goes, you look like you work at a video game store. I'm not sure if he meant that as a compliment or not, but I think that's kind of what you're going for there, huh? That, you know, I mean, arguably you and I were camera professionals.
Right.
We knew our job.
Yep.
And we just dressed in whatever, you know.
We dressed in what worked. I mean,
I felt comfortable in ripped jeans and a t-shirt, so
yeah,
they let me wear that.
Right, and since I was working morning show, I certainly wasn't going to dress up in nice stuff when, let's face it, as camera guys in a studio, you never know what you're going to face.
Yeah.
So you had to be comfortable, the clothes had to be durable, blah, blah, blah.
And you never knew how long you're going to be standing there. Thank you, election night 2008.
No kidding. But But that's what I'm saying is the 90s brought in this deal of going, you can be comfortable and still be a professional. That's the lasting thing of 90s fashion. That's still around today.
I'm remembering some of the really horrible 90s fashion. Like, do you remember those? I can't remember if they had pants for this or if it was just shirts. Those color-changing heat shirts.
Hypercolor, yep.
Where, for those of you that don't know, it would be like, you know, some of that gaudy 90s purple-pink kind of mesh thing.
Yeah.
And then it would be heat-sensitive, so somebody could, like, take their hand and put their hand on the back, and then it would leave the impression in the color for a few hours. Yeah,
they would change the color for, you know, until you washed them.
And it's like, okay, that... Who thought that was going to be a long-lasting thing? That has gimmick written all over it. I'm really surprised that came out in the 90s. That is such an 80s thing, isn't it? That is so 80s, man.
To be fair, it came out in the early 90s, for one. We were still in high school when they came out.
I know, but I'm just saying, doesn't that... It does. 80s.
And it lived the life of gimmick fashion. It was there from like 91 to 92. And then hypercolor went away. Well, because, like I said, people washed them. And once you wash them, and especially put them in the dryer, they don't work anymore.
Well, and then you also had, like I just brought up, that gaudy color. Somehow pink/purple became mainstream for clothing in the early 90s, especially, of all things, amongst the skater culture.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
What the fuck was it with guys wearing pink on skateboards?
Okay, here is where that comes from. That, believe it or not, and if you look at the 2000s, the 70s, the 60s, the 50s, it's a cyclical thing. Because in the 70s, and as awful and gaudy and horrible as they were, you did have a lot of color. You had everything from baby blue... leisure suits.
I think you had too much color in the 70s.
You had a shitload of color in the 70s. The 80s come around, and I don't know if you noticed this, but for men, it became that 80s suit with maybe, you know, the most color you can get is maybe a little pastels here and there. But for the most part, for most professionals in the 80s, it was the black power suit with the splash of color in the shirt and the splash of color on the tie, but that's the way it was. And even down below, you had things like plain white tees, and there weren't a whole lot of graphic tees in the 80s. You always had your concert tees and stuff like that with logos on it, but there wasn't a whole lot of colorful graphics otherwise. And you had pretty much blue jeans if you were casual, or again, going formal, you went pretty basic.
Acid washed.
But in the 90s, we rediscover color. And it got a whole lot cheaper to produce.
But it was actually gaudier, like I just said, like gaudier than the 70s.
Well, it was actually cheaper to produce these fluorescent dyes. And so people went, look what you can all afford now. And people went crazy with it. And they did. And in many cases, yes, it was gaudier than the 70s, but somehow it hurt the eyes a little bit less than, say, stripes and checks together, or I don't know why, but somehow I look at your standard 70s, like especially the mod fashions, and I just get motion sick.
Well, you also had the hairstyles. Now, every decade's got their bad hairstyles.
Every decade has bad hair.
I get that. But there's something, and now maybe this is nostalgia and me just looking back. If you argue with me on that, I can't really fight with you. But to me, the really gaudy, over-the-top 80s hairstyles were at least somewhat, we were trying something radically different, especially the punk hairstyles. In the 90s, it just seemed like lazy hairstyles. It just seemed like... And yes, they did this with Farrah Fawcett in the 70s and Pat Benatar in the 80s, but I don't think I've ever seen so many in the 90s like the, oh, I want to get the Jennifer Aniston. Oh, I want to get this actress's hair. Oh, I want to get this actor's hair. Oh, I want, you know, it's like everyone wanted to look the same. You know, you'd go to a party at Halloween and there'd be 9 Jennifer Anistons there.
Okay.
And you go, oh, come the fuck on.
Okay, okay. For one thing, it's always been that way. Somebody gets popular, they have a unique
That's why I pointed
style.
Out the Pat
out.
Benatar and the Farrah Fawcett.
Pat Benatar, Farrah Fawcett, going back even further, Breakfast at Tiffany's.
I don't remember who starred on that. I remember the movie, but I don't remember. Who cares?
There are people screaming it at the radios. So, as we, you know, that happens every decade. And let's take a moment and step back to the 80s. Because I could go to a party in the 80s.
And there'd be 20 Pat Benatars.
There wouldn't be 20 Pat Benatars. But at least where I grew up, they all had that 80s moose poof in the front.
We used to call that the unicorn.
Well, yeah, I mean, all the girls would have that 80s moose poof with their bangs and the long hair.
But see, I've got a thing really for metal chicks, and metal chicks did that, so that, you know.
There you go.
Metal chicks are my thing.
I know, but if you're going to be subjective, you got to look. You go to a metal party, and you got 20 metal chicks with all the same haircut.
I know.
Come on.
I know.
It's the same. It was the same in the 90s. Everybody wanted the Jennifer Aniston. Everybody wanted the Brad Pitt. Everybody wanted the Vanilla Ice. No, they didn't. They were sane.
Well, and then...
On the urban side... I was just about to say,
I don't want to come across as racist, but black people had some of the worst hair of the 1990s.
Okay. First off...
You can't really fight with me because their hair was terrible. I'm just talking their styles.
No,
their
it
hair
really
styles.
Wasn't. When it comes to urban styles and when it comes to stuff like that, yeah, it took a lot of work. Yeah, it looked a little bit goofy. But let's be honest, the ones that we remember, like Kid from Kid and Play, had the huge, gigantic high top fade.
Yep.
Goofy, but a trademark. And you didn't see a whole lot of those.
You saw the Afro make a comeback for whatever reason in the late 90s.
And the Afro, even in the 70s. Awful hairstyle.
Yeah, it didn't look good then.
It didn't look good then. Afro puffs looked even worse. And yeah, they made a comeback in the 90s. I'm not quite sure why.
But then you had all the stylizations like the fro hat and the shaven words into the back of your head and then shaving the race tracks. And it's like, are you stupid? What are you doing?
Yes. But we were even making fun of that back in the 90s.
But white people had one that was actually worse. The rat tail.
Okay. All right.
That was worse than anything black people did to their hair.
The rat tail got its start in the late 80s.
I didn't see them until
in the South.
I didn't see them until the 90s.
They got started in the South, actually probably mid to late 80s, somewhere around there.
I think the rat tail is actually dumber than the mullet.
And beyond, yeah, I was going to say the next step is the mullet.
And I think the rat tail is sort of the retarded stepchild of the mullet.
You know, and I will give you that. You look back on them now and they looked awful. And I had a mullet. I did. Back when I had hair, I had a mullet. I had hair down to about the middle of my back. And you look back and you look ridiculous. But when it comes to fashion, you have to look at what stayed. Because fashion is always going to have those flash in the pan, stupid, stupid things. I mean, leisure suits in the 70s look awful. Flash in the pan, died. Disco fashion, flash in the pan, died. But what stayed?
But to them, let's talk about leisure suits and disco fashion. I think those people, especially in the disco scene, really thought that was not a flash in the pan. They really thought this was here to stay.
Well,
I'm not so sure much of leisure suits, but the disco scene, they really thought this was there, that this was not going away.
And they thought so in the 80s with some of their 80s fashion stuff. And I mean, look, Epcot Center. You look at the architecture and the stuff like that, that is an expression of fashion. But you walk into Epcot Center and you go, oh my God, they built this in 1980. Just looking at the buildings and stuff like that. And yeah, Disney's throwing a lot of makeup onto it right now, going, no, it really is still future world. It is, I promise, I swear. But, you know, you look at it and you go, wow, this just screams 80s. And you look back at these flash in the pan stuff and they're nice little time capsules. You had the same thing in the 90s with the slacker fashion and with, you know, with the stuff like that. But when it comes to me and judging fashion, I judge what stayed. First off, what stayed out of the 60s, 70s was blue jeans. Everybody decided, hey, denim is comfortable, durable, and lasts a while, and it's cheap to produce. So it stayed. We got them. What stayed out of the 70s? I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to think of something that got
not polyester.
Well, some of the man-made fabrics and some of the durable man. The one nice thing that was great about leisure suits, and I had one when I was a little kid, believe it or not, and was that you could just take them and like pour fluid all over them, and it'd all just kind of roll off because it was all man-made fabric, and basically you were wearing plastic.
Yeah,
some of that stayed, and they started combining that with natural fabric, so it felt a little bit better, but it's a little bit more durable. That's why we have cotton poly t-shirts and stuff like that.
Well, and speaking of t-shirts, one of the other things, and now maybe this is just the stuff I was buying, the concert tees I was buying, the comic book t-shirts I was buying, the actual t-shirts themselves got cheaper, thinner, and didn't last as long. I've got 80s, you know, like concert t-shirts that have been through hundreds and hundreds of washes and are still nice and vibrant and don't have holes in them. I've got ones I bought in the 90s that after three washes fell apart.
Part of that is because of the quality that you were doing. People started, especially bands and comedians and stuff, and where you go and you buy t-shirts like this, they came up with a way to make cheap t-shirts. You buy cheap t-shirts, and you just sell them, and
the 90s
they make
had
more money.
I mean, the quality of a t-shirt was cheaper in the 90s.
Unless you buy your t-shirt like without graphics on it, and if you buy a decent t-shirt, I still have t-shirts from the 90s that have lasted.
Most of my 90s ones have been destroyed, but my 80s ones are still fine.
Well, again,
it's weird.
Again, it depends on where you get them and the quality of shirts and stuff, because I still have plenty of 90s stuff, including flannel shirts. But my point was, let's see what stayed out of the 90s. Business casual stuck around. Comfort stuck around. The fact that, again, you're not... There's more of a concentration on what you do at work versus what you look like. Now, there's still plenty of... What you look like makes a difference, especially if you're in retail or a more
customer service industry.
Yeah, it's still there. But at the same time, when I worked at Radio Shack, it was khakis and a denim uniform shirt was what you wore. Versus when my manager started at Radio Shack, when they were wearing brown pants, brown shirt, and a bright orange jacket.
So what did you look like? You were picking up trash on the highway?
No, it wasn't quite that kind of a bright orange. It wasn't like the day glow. This is prior to day glow. But it was this orange jacket, you know, suit jacket with a I believe an orange tie.
So we look like we're going hunting.
No, you more looked like a big pumpkin. Again, it wasn't the day glow orange. It wasn't the hunting orange. It wasn't quite that orange. That stuff wasn't around yet. But
all right. Well, we spent way too much time on fashion.
So. Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Is fashion comfort came out of the 90s.
I think some of the ugliest clothes ever made came out of the 90s.
And this coming from a man who looks at the 70s, going, yeah, that's what I want to dress like.
I never said I wanted to dress like the 70s. I just said they weren't as gaudy as the 90s.
This coming from the man who has had the same fashion uniform since 1982.
Your point being, I find something I like and I stick with it. What's your problem?
Anyway.
No, I'm serious. What's your fucking problem?
My problem is that the rest of the world has grown up and moved on.
Like I give a shit about the rest of the world.
That's obvious.
Yeah. Your point being?
My point is being made by you right now.
What's next?
I don't want to grow up. Anyway. All right. So, next.
We have news.
Now, this one, I'm not going to fight with you about. I'm just going to justify.
Because to me, I mean, okay, there was always, you know, CNN's been there since the late 70s.
Right.
Really since the 80s, but they've technically existed since the 70s. But you never got that 24-hour news cycle until about the mid-90s, really with Clinton's impeachment hearings.
Clinton's impeachment hearings and really the first Gulf War.
Right. And what happened was, because it's funny, if anybody out there can watch an entire local newscast from 1987 and then watch a local newscast from 1997, other than the fashions and the camera equipment being better, you tell me what the biggest change you see is. The length and depth of the stories. You'd see the top story. They'd spend the first 5 minutes of the broadcast bringing you both sides, lots of video, lots of sound bites, and you'd maybe have seven total stories in your A block. By 1997, you would have 27 stories in your A block, and everything would be...
Yeah, headline.
Just because you had to get so much in because the audience was becoming more and more visually illiterate. Well, I don't care about this hunting license story. I'm going to turn the channel. Well, the hunting license story now is only 30 seconds, so you might as well stick around to see what the next story is after that, right? It became more hyperactive, and you started losing the news.
Yeah, I can't. You started losing the in-depth news. You got a whole lot more headlines. You started losing the depth. I can't fight you on that one.
And you also got the more sensationalistic stuff. Because you had Hard Copy and A Current Affair and those types of shows you were fighting with. You had the rise of Jerry Springer and the Springerization of TV. So now, instead of in the 80s where you would specifically not show the two celebrities throwing punches, now that's your tease, is the two celebrities throwing punches at each other, because that'll get people to tune in.
I can't.
You just, the news got dumbed down, and it hurts.
Yes, you're right. However, the world does correct itself. It really does.
I sure shit haven't seen it when it comes to news.
Oh, you're. That's because you're looking in the wrong place. You see, yes, television news, what USA Today did to newspapers, headline news CNN did to TV news. Shorter stories, headlines, more stuff on the front page with splashes of color, only, of course, with video, it was splashes of sensationalism.
But
now, wait a minute.
Okay.
However, the 90s gave us... a tool. And here's the difference between news today and news in the 80s. Back when all we had was TV and newspaper giving us stuff, and TV, radio, and newspaper giving us stuff, then it was a journalist's responsibility to go in depth. And you got plenty of in-depth reporting on TV and whatnot, but talk to an older person and they say even what they did in the 70s and 80s on TV was nothing compared to what the newspaper did back in the Edward R. Murrow days and in the days of Watergate and stuff like that. If you wanted to go in depth, you went to the newspaper, where you had quite a few paragraphs of one story. They just didn't have time on TV Now in the 90s, now that we have headline TV, headline newspaper, headline radio, and now it's the internet. If you want to go in depth, it's no longer the journalist's responsibility to go in depth. It is the
blogger,
viewers or listeners or citizen journalists' responsibility to go in depth into the story and put the information
that's
out there for
sick
people
that it's to come see. To that.
Why? Why is that sick?
Because the journalist should be the one that does journalism. The person on the street shouldn't be the one that goes to the journalist and go, I got both sides of the story.
Yeah, I'll give you that. Journalism has certainly changed, but now journalism itself is a commercial product. Unfortunately, that's the way things have gone. I say thank God for bloggers and vloggers and stuff like that that still do go, no, this is a big deal. This is in depth. Thank God we have the internet and can seek this stuff out.
Well, and what I was trying to say when I was kind of interrupting you but not really meaning to was you also saw the degradation of what actually news was, what qualified as news. In the 80s, and I'm just talking on a national level right now. Let's leave the locals out. On a national level, something would have to be really big and really serious to be reported. Okay? Then in the 90s, you got what celebrity is sleeping with who is now our top story. In the 80s, that would have been, why don't we leave that to Entertainment Tonight? And then all of a sudden, Fox News and MSNBC and CNN and you know, NBC Nightly News are you know, I know this was 2000s, but, you know, Mel Gibson's racist rant. No, that's Entertainment Tonight. That's not news.
I agree. I can't fight you on this. I can tell you where it came from, though. Because
partially the Bill Clinton thing, because,
you know, partially the Bill,
well, because that one straddled the line. Technically, it's the impeachment of a president. That is news.
Yes.
But it was so sensationalistic, you know, because it was about him getting a blowjob and coming on a girl. That's sensationalistic.
I agree, but that was just a trigger. That was, to tell you the truth, that was the stumbling block. We were already running toward that, toward the goal of what's there today. The difference is, and the really big difference actually came about in the late 80s. That was the proliferation of cable.
Yeah.
So, you know, it used to be that we had NBC, ABC, CBS, and PBS.
And Fox in 87.
Well, yeah. It used to be that we had four networks, one of which was public TV. And that was it. So that's all they were competing with. Suddenly in the 80s and in the 90s, when cable really became penetrated households in the U.S. and went crazy, then they're competing with Fox News, CNN, Headline News, the Weather Channel, for God's sake, which now has very little to do with weather anymore. And you saw all of this competition amongst all of these channels. So what they discovered was the shorter, more sensational stories sold.
Okay, I know you don't get HBO, but it's just like the that recent episode of The Newsroom, that really good Aaron Sorkin series,
yes,
that,
yes,
that you'd like a lot.
I'm familiar with it.
In the last episode when we're recording this that had just aired, they were trying to make their show all about real news. You know, we're not going to handle any sensationalistic stuff. But the ratings were dropping during the Casey Anthony trial, so they were forced to cover Casey Anthony 15 minutes out of their hour-long show every night, and you just saw the souls get sucked out of the whole cast and crew that we're becoming everything we fought against because
that
networks are making us, because all of our viewers are going to Nancy Grace because Nancy Grace is covering Casey Anthony and people want the dumb shit.
Didn't,
so my point is, I'm blaming you out there. If you people didn't go, I want to see people fighting on the news, then the news would still be the news. I'm blaming the viewers.
I can't blame the viewers exclusively. You're right. And by the viewers, us too. We're in there.
I don't watch the news
for
the sensationalism. I get mad at it. I go, I want to see the real news. And then, oh, they're talking about Mel Gibson calling cops Jews running the world. Click. I don't have any interest in
you
this.
You also get mad if Dr. Pepper changes the graphics on their bottle.
Yeah.
But the point is, Josh, that yes, this is a change. However, again, thank God for the 90s, because now we have the internet to where if I hear a headline I want to hear, I can go in depth. I can get firsthand sources now too that I couldn't normally get before. You know, normally you're right. That was up to the journalist. That's changing. Is it a good thing? I don't know. And like I said, I'm not fighting with you on this at all, because you're right.
But I wish news would go back to the way it was handled.
I don't want it to go back to the way it was handled.
I wish it would stop being sensationalistic. I wish it would start being stories again and not bites. And I wish news producers would stop looking at this will make a great promo instead of this is a great story.
I don't want it to change back. I really don't. And I don't think it ever will, because
I don't think it will either.
I think that's unrealistic. However, I want to, you're right. It is the viewer's responsibility. And part of the viewer's responsibility in this case is change it. Stop watching.
They're not going to.
I know, but stop watching. Go to the internet for your news. It's what I do. I don't watch local news anymore. I don't watch national news anymore. I go to the
only
internet.
Time I watch local news, seriously, when it comes to the weather. If it sounds like there's a big thunderstorm coming, I want to see how bad it's going to be.
Yeah, that's what it's handy
you
for.
Know?
But, you know, so I can't fight with you on that one. However, like I said, the 90s, the market corrected itself with the internet.
Well, we'll get into the internet in a little bit more.
And we'll get into the internet.
The internet will be next episode. We're not going to be able to fit the internet in this one.
You're probably right. So the next thing that we want to talk about is print.
Yes, because there was both good and bad when it came to the 90s in print, okay?
Yes,
You saw the proliferation, there I said it, of basically anything that it existed had a magazine devoted to it in the 80s. And in the 90s, that happened as well, except instead of having a magazine devoted to it, you had a half dozen magazines devoted to it. You name anything, a sport, a movie genre, entertainment, fashion, there were multiple magazines. I mean, the one I'm really thinking of is horror movies. Because, you know, in the 80s, you had a couple of horror movie magazines. In the 90s, I could name you a dozen that were on the shelf every month that were covering the exact same stuff. And you'll notice that's a glut. There's not enough information, and there's too many magazines. And you'll notice most of them don't exist anymore.
You want to know something? A great illustration of your point is that I have always been into flight simulation since about 1984, and we picked up Microsoft Flight Simulator 1 for the Apple IIe.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a Microsoft product for the Apple. Anyway, it's something, again, another passion that Dad and I share. In the 90s, in college, when I went down to the local bookstore, I looked, and at one point, there were 14 magazines devoted to computer flight simulation.
And that's not even counting just the computer magazines.
That's
either.
Yeah, that's not just the computer magazines. These are specifically computer flight simulator magazines. There were 14 in total. There were three devoted specifically to Microsoft Flight Simulator. So these are three magazines devoted to one
this
program.
This is something I've often wondered about. Even today, how do such specific magazines find something to write about every month?
I'm not sure, but I can tell you where that came from. That was a change in, I forget what the hell, the Condé Nast, that's the publishing company. They looked at television and they said, hey, this cable thing got really popular because now you have the Microsoft Flight Simulator channel. Which you don't, but
I know what you're going
yeah,
for.
Yeah, you have these little narrow, it went from broadcasting to narrowcasting on their little channels. And they were successful. There were, you know, Comedy TV, Comedy Central before it was, you know, Comedy Central.
It was the Comedy Channel.
The Comedy Channel. It found its niche, and it found an audience big enough to support just that one little thing.
Actually, it didn't.
I know, but this is what Condé Nast saw.
Okay.
And so they, in the boatload of magazines that they ended up publishing, tried to do the narrowcasting thing with print. It was a reflection of, it worked for cable, it should work for magazines too.
Well, and see, one of the things that happened to magazines was the same thing that we just talked about happening to the news, and that sensationalism. Because take Omni magazine, its rise and fall is a perfect example of how the 90s killed it and the sensationalistic. It started in 78, so technically it's a 70s magazine. But it rose throughout the 80s as being a science fiction, science fact magazine. You know, they'd cover some, you know, like the new Star Trek movie or whatnot, but most of the magazine was science fact.
Right.
Then after Bob Guccione started getting sick and his son started taking over the business, he started taking over Omni. He started seeing the rise in all the paranormal TV shows and the UFOs. And you saw this hard science magazine very quickly, within the course of almost 2 years, shift into all being about what do your dreams mean, and if you were abducted by a UFO and you saw the magazine become sensationalistic, and according to them, it was the only thing we could do to survive. Sales were down. And I'm going, then you die a dignified death. You don't become a conspiracy theory fucking nutball magazine.
Yeah, Alex Jones Monthly.
Yeah, and that's what Omni became in its last few years.
Yeah.
It became all... I mean, I don't think there's a single issue in their last couple of years that did not have a cover story on a UFO or an alien abduction.
But on the other side, you had the rise of the tech magazine.
Again, and oversaturation, again, though, because yes, every company put out one.
You're right. Oversaturation. Still oversaturated.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are magazines.
Just look at the video game. In the 90s, you had EGM, you had GamePro, you had the genre, you had Xbox Magazine, PlayStation Magazine.
New Edge,
Nintendo Power, you had the computer gaming magazines, you had the Sega Magazine, the TurboGrafx-16 Magazine. It's like, there's not enough video games to support 20 magazines, people!
Right, and especially if you hook your magazine onto a certain system. Systems have lifestyles,
lifespans.
Life cycles, lifespans. You've just given your magazine, a termination date.
Well, and
However, There was a rise in the 90s that I think is what's going to... I think that print in the long term, maybe not with magazines, but at least with newspapers and with some general magazines, I think it's going to die. I think print is going to move into that niche market, and that's the only way it's going to survive. However, there are a few magazines that went, you know what? Let's take an artistic look at the world. Let's let our article literally shape the article. And the big survivor that came out of that movement, Next Generation Gaming, if you were in the UK, that's a good example of one. Game Informer does it somewhat today with their layouts. But the big granddaddy of them all was Wired.
Which to me... I kind of like their writing, although I lost a lot of respect for them over the Joss Whedon thing. But I think it's a cluttered mess.
It's
like the magazine now is made. You look at an issue from the 90s and an issue from today, and it's like someone with ADD took over the magazine. Everything's splintered and different fonts on the same page, and they're all short little articles, spread about the magazine, because it's just... It's like they're not satisfied. We can't have one page devoted to a single article, or the reader will lose interest. We got to have 9 things on each page.
And that would be the downfall of Wired. Wired hasn't done that.
Wired is a mess to me.
Wired still has the long form article there
in the middle of the magazine.
All the
first third of any given issue is a splintered mess.
But you look at Wired in the 90s, and it wasn't that way.
Right.
It really was a beautiful work of art. I don't know what happened with that.
I think it's sort of they want the print page to look like a web page.
Yeah.
Which I think that's going to be their downfall.
But really, to tell you the truth, I think that print as a whole is going to it's going away.
And see, I think unfortunately LFP saw that, and that's for those that don't realize. And you might. Larry Flint Publications.
Thank you.
Larry Flint Publications. Do you realize how many non-adult magazines they put out in the 90s?
Tons.
They put out at one point 39 different magazines in a month. Three were adult magazines. They published stuff like Bridal Monthly and Good Housekeeping and Yacht Keeper and stuff like that. You people would not imagine how many 90s magazines, if you look at the Indica on the front, on the inside front cover, you'd go, editor-in-chief Larry Flint?
Yeah.
What the hell?
But that's what I'm saying is I think that print will eventually go away. And I think it's going to be replaced with electronic media.
And see, I think there are ways to keep print really alive. Especially, let's just take movie magazines. If you use Chris Gore's philosophy of playing both sides against each other. What his philosophy was with Film Threat when he went to Larry Flint Publications was, okay, We put Macaulay Culkin on the cover. We put Batman on the cover. We put Oliver Stone on the cover. But then you cover all the obscure shit in the magazine.
Right.
So you cater to both the cult film fans and the mainstream fans at the same time.
Right.
But most magazines don't want to do that. We're either a cult magazine or we're a mainstream magazine. That's it.
Right. And that's a shame. That is going to be a change. I think that the only magazines that are going to survive are going to be niche stuff and stuff that hangs around. We've covered this.
But I think the way for print to really come back as a magazine form is don't cater to the internet. Have great exclusive content to your magazine and don't put it on your webpage.
Or cater specifically to the internet. Make your magazine a time capsule and make, I mean, with the way things change, make it a huge time capsule and cater to the true internet devotee.
And see, I think it's just the opposite. Because one of the things I don't understand with most, especially movie magazines, why would I buy the print version when all the articles are for free on your website? What you need to do is you make all the print articles exclusive. You basically make the best stuff for the print version, and you don't put it online. I don't understand why they say, well, we're going to give it away for free, but we want you
but
to
I
buy it,
too.
But I
don't want to pay for the print version, and I'd rather just read what's online.
But that's why I said you take the best stuff and you put it in the print version.
But if my magazine is a work of art that reflects the times, a la Wired, a la whatever you're publishing, I mean, you know, a la the Sears catalog, for God's sake. You look at a catalog from 1976, and you're like, ah, this is most definitely from 1976. You know,
that's just because all the kids playing with the G.I. Joes had fucking afros.
You make it a time capsule. You make it something that reflects, and you make it something that I want to put in an archive, that I want to keep, that I want to have. Versus,
but see, to go back to LFP, they're doing it right with Hustler. Do you know why people buy Hustler still today? They're not buying it for the girls. They're buying it for the articles, which Larry Flint does not put on the Hustler webpage. They're buying it for the in-depth articles, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
They're saying you can only get certain things in the print magazine. Yeah, there's boobs and stuff too. Nobody buys Hustler for the lit girls anymore.
Nope.
Which I think that's their biggest downfall, is the fact that they still cater to that with the covers. The covers are just some average-looking pretty girl. And it's like, no. You should go to the original-ass kind of covers you had in the 80s. Those really unique, you know, painted covers, and you know, the pubic hair American flag bikini covers and the meat grinder
again,
covers.
Again, make your magazine not only have good articles in it, but a work of art.
Right. And to me, that's Hustler's downfall right now, is it looks like every other adult magazine out there, and that's just pointless to me. But We'll handle, let's see, what's next? The technology and the internet, I think. Technology, internet, and comic books are next.
Technology, internet, and, well, I don't know if we talked about comic books or not.
We're going to talk comics next week.
Okay.
So we'll probably start with that and then seg into tech.
Yeah.
And I got one of them, too.
Technology and the internet is going to be where we really, really go at each other's throats.
Yes. So go to 1201beyond.com. Check out the Amazon shit, and
clear your cookies. Turn off your ad blocker.
And what I'd really like our listeners to do is spread the shows around a little bit.
Please.
If you guys like these shows, because we've gotten so much positive criticism
yes,
on our internet reviewers
useful
episode.
Criticism.
On our internet reviewers episode. And I'm not going to say who, but certain actual internet critics that were mentioned in that kind of came back at us and said, yeah, you're kind of right. I really can't fight with you on that one. What I'd really like to do, I'd like to see the critics like Doug Walker or James Rolfe, guys, show them the episode. Let's see if they contact us, because we're giving them an open forum.
Yeah, please.
If you want to retort what we said, you are more than welcome to come on the show.
Exactly.
But we've got to get through their handlers first.
Exactly. And that can be difficult. Nonetheless.
But all of our shows, spread them around.
Yeah, share us with some
spread
of your...
Shredder?
Shut up. God. Blah, 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 blah.
There you go.
Talk, you know, share us with your friends. Use us as a launching point for any conversations you want to have on stuff that we're going to cover. If you have any show ideas, catch us on Facebook. Give us an email at
we will listen to suggestions.
Yes, we do. LostInTheStaticShow@gmail.com if you want to email us. And
talk hard.
Definitely. What the fuck does that mean?
It's from the movie Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater. Talk hard, where he's a pirate radio DJ.
No, I remember. That's the dumbest
thing
I've
ever heard. Fuck you. That's an awesome movie. No, that movie's brilliant.
Terrible.